Hello, welcome to this week's Opening Bell. I'm boxing news editor Tris Dixon, joined by John Dennan, fresh from Glasgow. John, how's it going?
Good. Recovering from my from the full Glasgow experience.
What was more hectic to cover, the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow or the London Olympics? What do you think you spent more time doing?
I think the days were kind of fuller at the Commonwealth Games because of the way they sort of structured the tournament, as in, I remember at the Olympics they had a morning session and an evening session, so there were sort of hours to kill waiting around at the Excel between them, whereas here it was...
Relentless.
Yeah, it was relentless, sort of every waking hour, and also there was no sort of qualification standard for the tournament, so there were actually a lot of boxers entered, so there were a lot of bouts, and the sessions were... You know, it's pretty grueling when you're watching Mauritius versus Kiribati at 11 p.m. on a Monday night.
Okay, good stuff. With regards to the Commonwealth Games, who was the boxer of the tournament? Had there been a Val Barker trophy, who would you have given it to?
Oh, that's a good question. There are a lot of quality performances. Obviously, Nicola Adams gets the headlines because of making history. But I thought Josh Taylor was fantastic throughout. He was in a, you know, a really tough weight division, and there was a mixed bunch, so some divisions were weaker than others, but 64 had some quality boxers in it, and I thought Taylor put in a series of world-class performances to win that.
Who were you most disappointed by? Who did you have high expectations of but didn't really deliver?
Well, I thought Andrew Selby was sort of almost a dead cert for the gold medal, and he just kind of, it flamed out with this weird situation with his mouth guard falling out, and he got points taken off for that. And you know, fair play to the Scot who beat him, Reece McFadden, again, sort of rose to his moment in the spotlight. But it would have, you know, it would have been nice to see Selby in the mix in the later stages. Sort of, it was a great platform for him, and he really lost that opportunity.
Was there anyone in the games who sort of came from nowhere to really make a name for you? You know, like, we would have expected certain performances from the likes of Anthony Fowler, some of the top Scottish, British, or Scottish and English fighters. Is there anyone that really you weren't aware of before who now has really staked a claim to be in a bigger name?
Scott Fitzgerald, he did come from nowhere. He was a kind of a surprise selection for England, and you know, he wasn't even on the podium squad, which is sort of the elite squad on GB. And he not only won the gold medal, but he did it in sort of great style. Had a couple of hard fights. It was knocking people over, so he was a real revelation in that tournament, and that was his first major international. So he's definitely one to watch in future.
And Nicola Adams, though, although she's made history now, having won Commonwealth and Olympic gold, she didn't have things her own way, did she?
No, definitely not in the final. Northern Ireland's Michaela Walsh really sort of came to fight and wasn't going to give Nicola Adams an easy ride. So that was, you know, she pushed her in the final, and that rivalry is going to be really interesting over the next couple of years, because Walsh is probably, you know, she's quite young, I think still only 18, but either way, she's young, new on the scene, so she's going to get better. And she was not happy about the decision going against her. So she's definitely going to be, a strong rival for Adams in qualifying for the Olympic Games and presumably at the Olympic Games itself.
Someone who got a lot of the headlines was Scottish personality Charlie Flynn. Emotion and passion doesn't really cover it. What would you do if you're Charlie Flynn? What would be your next move?
I don't know. I think probably turning pro on the sort of wave of publicity and popularity that he has. Obviously, he's still got to develop as a boxer. I thought it was more a triumph of willpower and effort.
Spirit,
exactly. Triumph of the human spirit rather than necessarily technical boxing skill. So he could, you know, he could, if he stayed amateur, maybe he'd improve as a boxer, but this could be the right moment to sort of turn professional with sort of all this attention he's got.
We're 2 years away from Rio now, the Olympics of... the next Olympics. Who's nailed on from the Commonwealth Games, any nationality, who's nailed on for gold?
At the Olympic Games? Oh, that's a tough question. Nailed on.
Because obviously you're factoring in a massive realm of massively talented nations then, aren't you? You're looking at the Eastern Bloc and obviously Cuba. The Americans always seem to have a point to prove, certainly recently when they've sort of faltered massively. Yeah. So it's a completely different ball game. But okay, maybe not who's nailed on. Who's going to be the guys who are going to challenge the dominance from Eastern Europe and Cuba?
I think...
And Brazil, because I think Brazil will have a really strong team, won't they?
Yeah, they should do. And it's, you know, home advantage does go a long way in boxing. Nailed on. You know, Fowler's going to be at the top of the amateur sport. He already has a world bronze. So I could definitely see him being a significant factor at middleweight. If Paddy Barnes stays amateur, you know, Zhu Shimi's gone pro now, and Paddy, you know, I think Zhu Shimi only got past him on count back, I think, at 2012. And Paddy, as well as being this sort of, you know, he's a sort of joker outside the ring, but can really do the business in the ring. So he could do well. Conlon at bantamweight is a class act.
The other nationalities like New Zealand and further afield? Anyone there that caught the eye that might be pitching for medals in Rio?
I was very impressed by the New Zealand light heavyweight. He seemed very skillful and had a great style for amateur boxing. He is young though, so he was quite, you know, he was quite skillful, kept people at range from him. But I do wonder if like a tough Russian or a tough Ukrainian would be able to sort of close him down and hurt him. I think the light heavyweight from Mauritius, who was quite a hard puncher, did get through. So he might not have the power to keep the big guys off him. I'm trying to think who else at the other divisions. I mean, it was really, the Commonwealths were dominated by the home nations.
Sure.
Overall, they were a lot stronger.
Sure, we can see that with your medal table in this week's issue. And guys, if you missed anything from the Commonwealth Games, pick up this week's Boxing News, because everything is in there, including that spectacular backward somersault from Joe Joyce. Joe Joyce, by the way, has he got a chance to follow in Anthony Joshua's footsteps in Rio?
I think so. He's not, I mean, he's a different style of fighter. He's not as, you know, Joshua had real power in his punches. Joyce sort of hits sternly, but his keys to victory are he's got a huge work rate, he throws a lot of punches, and that can be very effective at super heavyweight. He's pretty, even though he looks a bit sort of stiff, perhaps a touch robotic, he gets a lot of work done in the ring, so he's hard to beat. His flaw is letting too many, he gets hit too, he's tough, but he gets hit too often, which is fine against the slightly lower level guys because he can just outwork him and stay on them. But against these, there are a couple of boxers out there, you know, the likes from Russia or from Cuba, who can really punch hard. So if he doesn't make up for that deficiency, that could be a problem for him. But he could definitely factor in the medals.
Okay. Talking of you saying get hit too often, this sort of segues onto the next part of the podcast, really. Shannon Briggs is back in the news. I say hit too often. I remember his fight with Vitaly Klitschko back in 2010, where he took a real beating. Had claimed some arm injuries afterwards, which he did have. He wound up in hospital. This week he's been in the news because more than 4 million people have viewed his video where he goes into a Miami restaurant, calls out Vladimir Klitschko to his face, then proceeds to start eating Vladimir Klitschko's lunch or breakfast, whatever it was. And then Vladimir coolly pours himself a glass of water and then proceeds to pour it over Shannon Briggs' bald cranium. An irate Briggs is then led out, shall we say, under great duress from the restaurant. The clip, as I say, it's been seen more than 4 million times. It's on our website, along with a story about Bernd Bonte as to why Briggs isn't in the pecking order. But with all these cheap publicity stunts, it seems like a Briggs-Klitschko fight is getting some crazy sort of traction, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't want to see it. I don't think he stands a chance in the fight, and I don't think just popping up and acting like a lunatic should get you a shot at the heavyweight champion of the world. But you can just sort of see the momentum building, and if they see all these views for these you know, wild antics on YouTube. That's you know, that's a way of selling the fight.
It's kind of how one of the ways that David Haye got the Klitschko fight, wasn't it? Or got interest in the Klitschko fight, certainly when he sort of gate-crashed an arrival on a London elevator, if you remember, right, on an escalator where he and Vlad exchanged pleasantries. Maybe not pleasantries, but certainly had an exchange. Briggs, however, I don't think he's got any legitimate way of beating a top 10 fighter. So the only way he can get a Klitschko fight is to bang the drum, bang the publicity drum as loud as possible. Obviously, first and foremost, Klitschko's got to get past Kubrat Pulev in September. A straightforward win for Klitschko in September, even though Pulev's arguably the best out there for him at the moment.
I think it might be. I do think Pulev is probably the best available challenger. But then I didn't expect Klitschko to sort of dominate Povetkin, so not in an entertaining way, albeit, but completely dominated him. So it could be, I think Pulev would probably be a better challenge than that, but I would expect a Klitschko victory.
Yeah, guys, check out online the interview I've done with Bernd Bonta. He says firmly that next for Vladimir after Pulev, they're looking at the winner of Bermain Stiverne and Deontay Wilder, or even the winner of Fury, Derek Chisora, should that fight get rearranged. Briggs, does he beat a Deontay Wilder? Does he beat one of those fringe guys, do you think? Or do you think he will get put to sleep by someone like Wilder?
I do. I just don't see him, you know, at that level anymore. So I do think someone like Wilder would bomb through him. And also Klitschko, I mean, he's getting on. He can't have too many fights left with him. I'd rather see him in significant fights, you know, trying to unify the division than...
Well, one of the things that Lennox did well was When he won the title, he fought some of the top names, obviously, but he also started clearing out the second tier or the younger guys coming through, the likes of Michael Grant and David Tuer, who were sort of almost seen to be the next wave or the pretenders to the throne. Obviously, it ended with Vitali Klitschko and a bit of a messy finale that left a few questions. But the wins over Tuer and Grant and maybe one or two others sort of really put him on a different plateau. And I think Vitali, if he could fight some of the younger guys and Vladimir, and if he could clean out the likes of Fury and Wilder, then he could go into the sunset and obviously not be in a position where anyone else is left calling him out because there's no one there.
Yeah, absolutely.
One thing about Vlad, though, in this week's Heroes and Villains, we've asked the question, if you were Vladimir Klitschko, would you accept Shannon Briggs' challenge? Obviously, you've answered there. Don't give away what you said, but think of it, if you were a fighter and you're Vladimir Klitschko, and you're there sat tucking into your lunch and someone comes and shouts the odds in your face and then takes your food, starts eating it. And this is someone who's already been a pain in the backside at press conferences and at training camp. Do you want to fight him and give him a payday and give him a beating, or do you just want to stay, do you hire extra security to keep him away?
Personally, I would just keep him away. I wouldn't really give him the platform of a big fight and all the, you know, the press conference and stuff you'd have to do to build up to it. But, you know, these crazy things keep happening, and how come Shannon Briggs managed to be in the same restaurant stealing, you know, Klitschko's food? It's
set up? Do you think it's a set up? You're implying it, some kind of mischievous skullduggery.
I am. I don't know what's going on, but it's weird, and I don't like it.
Yeah, it's definitely weird. Definitely weird. So, Frankie Gavin, changing tacks. Frankie Gavin has lost for the first time as a professional. Danny Flexman was ringside to see Leonard Bundu cause something of an upset in a fight that was quite hard to call beforehand. So hard to call that I think I actually got it wrong. But Bundu Gavin, I mean, how do you plot a route back for Frankie Gavin now? Do you keep him at European level? Do you bring him back down to domestic level? What would you do next?
I don't know. I think you probably could keep him at European level in that this was a close fight that could have gone either way. And, Bundu is a quality operator. He'd be you say he's a very strong European champion, wouldn't you? He's right up there. So there's sort of no shame in the loss. I think it's more about how is Frankie going to recover from it? Is he going to learn the right lessons? How is it going to affect him psychologically? You know, I'd like to see a sort of new support structure come in, like getting a nutritionist, a strength and conditioning coach, you know, maybe even a sports psychologist, if I don't know if he's, you know, who he's using or if he's using anyone like that, or to support Tom Chaney, his coach. You know, so I think it would be good to see a new look Frankie Gavin. He's adamant that he can make welterweight, even though he sort of physically Bundu looked like a unit compared to him. I'd like to see a sort of, get some more support in for Frankie, and so that he can fulfil his potential, because he is a talent and at times boxed excellently in that fight, didn't he?
Do you think Tom Chaney's the man for the job to keep training him? They seem to have a special rapport.
Yeah, and I think it hasn't worked with other trainers. The fact that they go so far back could be a key for helping Frankie. So unless, you know, I think Tom Chaney probably should be involved in some way, and you know, maybe they might want to get sort of some additional help. I don't know if there's sort of a big name world class trainer who could sort of. I mean, would that work if another trainer came in to help out?
But yeah, we've seen that succeed and fail in the past. Sometimes two voices sometimes causes more trouble than there was in the first place. Be interesting to see what Bundu chooses to do. He said on the night that he either wants a shed load of cash for the rematch or a world title fight. He's obviously poised now, because they both had decent world ratings. He's poised to kick on and get a world title fight of sorts. Be interesting to see what does happen for him now. Just a quick word on Gavin. We knew that he had talent, we knew he had skill, he showed that in abundance in some parts of the fight. He was picking some nice shots, some short hooks and uppercuts, and moving off nicely. He also showed a lot of heart and bottle to rise from a heavy knockdown to the body, didn't he?
Absolutely, yeah. He did, because it didn't look like he was going to get up from that. But not only did he get up, he survived for the next couple of rounds, and even by the end of the fight was back boxing well. It's just, you know, it speaks a lot to his sort of character under pressure, that it's, you know, he does, there is grit about him, not just the sort of flashy skills.
Talking about grit, anyone fighting Sergey Kovalev is probably going to have to show a fair amount of it. In November, Bernard Hopkins is going to be the man fighting this tough light heavyweight champion. There are legitimate concerns that have been expressed from people in boxing for the health of Bernard Hopkins, who, let's not forget, is a title holder at light heavyweight. He's got two belts. Do you worry for Hopkins, who's 49 years old, going into a fight with Sergey Kovalev? Do you actually think it's a dangerous fight for him? Physically a dangerous fight? Not a dangerous fight, he could lose, but do you think it's physically a dangerous fight for him?
I think it is, just because he is so old, and Kovalev is, you know, such a dangerous puncher. It's that age has to catch up with Hopkins sooner or later. So this is all the ingredients to be, you know, potentially disastrous. But then Hopkins is a champion in the division, so it's a good fight to make. It's a unification fight. It makes sense in those terms. But yeah, I fear for Hopkins, but I'm not sure if I'd be in the minority there. Maybe a lot of people think Hopkins can actually win it.
Well, the thing is with Hopkins, he's shown time and again that with people who are down and listed really as one-dimensional punchers, be it Tavoris Cloud, be it Felix Trinidad, be it Jean Pascal, whether they can box a little bit or not, Kelly Pavlik as well, obviously. These guys who haven't really been tested and, should we say, taken into really deep waters before, though it may be harsh to say that about Pascal given the Froch fight and other things, but some of those guys, it's hard to see that Kovalev brings a massive amount more to the table than those guys did. But at the same time, Kovalev has been so impressive with tearing through everyone that he's gone through so far, that it's hard to see how you can stop him.
Yeah.
And obviously Hopkins now, I know we've been saying it for more than a decade, but Hopkins now is no spring chicken, and you know, he was young. He was a younger man when he was taking on the odds and battling the guys of like Trinidad, who's the Trinidad fight, for example, was 13 years ago, and everyone was saying that Hopkins was old, too old then. So it's kind of a cross section of things, isn't it? It's Kovalev being impressive, and you know, had a sort of marauding path up through the light heavyweight ranks, and Hopkins on the flip side, not being the fighter he was maybe 5, 10, 15 years ago. I think it's a hard fight to call, because Kovalev had to show us that he's a really thinking man's fighter, and he might have to do that against Hopkins.
Yeah. But then Hopkins in his last couple has been getting caught a little bit more than expected. And with Kovalev, it just seems like everything he hits you, wherever he hits you, everything
stays
hurts.
Hit.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. It's a fight. I'm fascinated by it. But we've seen in a poll this week actually that of three light heavyweight fights that we've mentioned, with Hopkins, Adonis Stevenson, and Kovalev all mentioned, that Hopkins Kovalev is the fight people are least interested in out of that trifecta. People quite understandably, the fight they all wanted, and it looked like we were going to get, was Adonis Stevenson, Sergey Kovalev. That's certainly on the back burner this year. Disappointed that we might miss out on that one?
Absolutely, yeah. It's such a huge miss for boxing, isn't it? It's like a great fight. We see that lots of people want to see it, and you know, the politics of the sport, and for whatever reason, have prevented it from happening. Though I am surprised, you know, such a small proportion want to see Hopkins Kovalev the least, because that is that fight is fascinating.
Yeah, well, maybe people want to see Stevenson Hopkins a little bit more, because the build up for that would be quite tasty. You'd imagine the press conferences there could be quite interesting, and obviously that sort of stuff sells now. There's a lot of fight fans who are into the build up and the 24/7s and the all access shows and everything else, the interviews that we get as well, not forgetting that,
obviously.
Politics of the sport to one side for a minute. Golden Boy have a show this weekend in Brooklyn, and it's fair to say we're less than enamoured by a couple of the fights on the bill, or you could even say all three. Danny Garcia is fighting Rod Salka in a fight that's so poor even the WBC have refused to sanction it as a title fight. Also, Lamont Peterson's fighting Edgar Santana. Now, obviously, you can see from the outside looking in what they're trying to do. The idea is that Garcia and Lamont Peterson use the night as a showcase for their skills to talk up a fight later in the year between the two of them. What's your take on these kind of fights where you kind of know who's going to win the fight beforehand, and it's basically an infomercial for what's going to happen down the line? Is that harsh on the paying public, or do people know what they're going to go and see?
It depends. With these sort of, you know, build-up fights, I think they need to have sort of something interesting about them, or some, you know, some sort of questions you need answered. Whether, you know, it's someone who's moved up a division recently, and you need to sort of gauge how they're going to fare. You know, in this particular case, I don't see why I can't just do Danny Garcia, Lamont Peterson straight away. Because I mean, I'm not even that desperate to see that one, so I'm not sure it needs this great build-up.
Okay, Danny Garcia, I mean, it's crazy what's happened to him. When you think last September he was the co-main event on the bill that featured Floyd Mayweather and Saul Alvarez. He fought and won as an underdog against Argentine puncher Lucas Matisse. He stunned a lot of people, boxed very well, busted Matisse up to an extent, certainly left him very, very dispirited. So it's crazy really now that we're a year on and the guy has been and he's fought what was dressed up as some kind of bizarre homecoming in Puerto Rico, when he's sort of clearly made out that he's a Philadelphia fighter through and through over the years, and now he's got Rod Salka in Brooklyn. I mean, what part of it where he beats Matisse in a good fight on a massive platform was so wrong that's ended up costing him basically a year of his professional career in terms of backward steps?
Yeah, I can't get my head around it. I'm not sure, you know, who's been making these decisions, and because that Matisse fight was a perfect platform to catapult him into, you know, into sort of, well, if not superstardom or something close to it, or certainly with a big
people
name.
Were calling for a Mayweather fight after that win.
Yeah, and that kind of performance would merit it, wouldn't it?
And even if he fights Peterson next, that's still a step down from Matisse. I mean, we saw what Matisse did to Peterson; he walked right through him.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, I can't quite figure out where they're going with Danny Garcia. One thing I will say is that he's not really, he doesn't seem to be keen to be pushing the pace on his career. When I've spoken to him a couple of times this year, he's been very, very patient, very passive about who he's fighting and where he's fighting and stuff. Hasn't really called the odds or called the shots.
Maybe it's his fault. Maybe he should be saying that, no, I'm better than the Rod Salkers of this world.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe, I mean, you certainly don't need the WBC to tell you that. But but we'll find out. Sometimes we've done this before, and it always makes me a bit loath to criticise a fight before it actually happens. We've seen massive upsets, and we've seen underdogs give it a really, really good go in the past. It's hard to see. You'd be a very brave or naive man to put money on a Rod Salka Edgar Santana double and then meeting on a pay-per-view fight down the line. But, I mean, it's...
Worth a cheeky fiver, though.
I'm not even sure it is. Yeah, I can't see it. But it's difficult, you know. Like I said, I think even should he beat Lamont Peterson later on this year, he's going to be no further forward than he was 12, 14 months ago. So, I don't know. Interestingly, though, next week, someone will be further forward than they were 12 or 14 months ago. Whether it's Sean Porter or Kell Brook remains to be seen. We've got a big feature with Sean Porter in this week's magazine. I've actually been working on the Brook Porter preview for next week's. And I tell you what, John, I've been looking forward to the fight. And I've always thought it was tough to call, but it's only when you sit down and write it when you think, blimey, that fight is hard to call. I spoke to Kel yesterday. Didn't give me the sort of massive confident spiel that you get from some fighters where you put the phone down and think, wow, I'm going to go and put the house on him. Didn't really get that, but he's quietly confident and he's been out in Vegas now for a couple of weeks. I don't know, John. I don't know which way to go. Who are you favouring, Brook or Porter?
I mean it's a great fight, and Porter's looked devastating in his last couple of outings, but then before that he wasn't really sort of tearing up the boxing world, and Brook's got the skills, but then hasn't, you know, he's had a long wait to get to this kind of level. So I think overall that would tilt me towards Porter, especially obviously seeing Brook sort of fading in the second half of fights. But I think it'll be very close. Like, it's a real fight. I think I'd probably just, if gun to my head, if I had to pick a winner, I'd pick Porter, but it's by no means.
I wasn't going to do the gun thing.
All right.
I wasn't, you know, I was going to ask you, but I wasn't going to go quite that far. But no, it is a tough fight to call. And like you said, there's pros, there's cons. We've seen arguably the best and worst of them. I think maybe that might be my fear with Brook. I wonder if we haven't seen the best of him and now he's stagnated because of the disappointment of missing out on the Devin Alexander fight, with a fight that was thrice cancelled, rescheduled, and then on. It was on and off, and, you know, it was so much chaos. I wonder if, you know, when you build yourself up to a fight, and I remember speaking to Dwayne Bobbitt, the former heavyweight contender, about this many, many moons ago. And when you build up for a fight and you're really looking forward to it and you really get up to it, and then it's cancelled, and then something goes on in its place, you go back up, but you don't go back up to where you were before the disappointment of the first one. So you go all the way up, you built up, then the fight's out, and you're deflated. And then, oh, you've got another fight, you've got something else to train for, but you don't go back up to that same level. I wonder if Brook's ever been able to key himself up as much as he was for those Devin Alexander fights.
Yeah.
It's a massive mental game for him. And you mentioned earlier, if Frankie Gavin does or doesn't need to see a sports psychologist, but it's something that Kell Brook could have done with perhaps over the last few months to try and gear him up for a fight, to try and get him back up to that level.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So the cover story this week is Karl Froch charging, "I'm not scared of anyone," and he's responding to quotes that have been attributed to him by HBO, which I think came from a Sky Sports show, where he's talked about Gennady Golovkin. The implication in the quotes that have been provided by HBO is that Froch is almost running scared of Golovkin. Matt Christie's got a really interesting piece with Froch in this week's, well worth checking out. Froch, would you say he's running scared of Golovkin, or should he be running scared of Golovkin?
I think probably most people should be running scared of Golovkin. I don't think Froch is scared. I think he's aware of the risks and isn't gonna take on those risks until he's getting the right rewards. Because Golovkin is dangerous, and he does seem, you know, he punches so hard at middleweight. I'm sure he'd be, you know, that punch power would, he'd be able to, even though he's not massive, he'd be able to take that up with him to super middleweight. But yeah, I think it's a great fight, Froch Golovkin.
If Froch has three more fights left, pick his opponents, pick the venues, and then I'll do it.
James DeGale at the O2.
When?
Before the end of this year.
Okay.
So what, November, December, if they can get that in.
Yeah.
Golovkin, Madison Square Garden in May 2015.
Okay.
And final retirement fight in Las Vegas in September against Chavez Jr. on a Floyd Mayweather show. And that's it.
Well, as long as you're thinking big. Okay, fair enough. Do you know what, I think the DeGale fight over here, I'm not a massive fan of Froch DeGale. I'd be interested, but I'm not all consumed by it at all. But I could see it making sense for November, December in the O2, providing Froch has done his BBC tumble thing and he's got enough time to train after that.
Around.
Which I think is going to take him out of the equation till late September at the very latest. So I'm not sure even then that he will be able to get a fight in before the end of the year. But say he could fight DeGale later this year, and I'm not sure that fight's a given for Froch. I think that could have a real banana skin written all over it in question of his motivation and the time scale and everything else. But say DeGale in the O2 almost in a farewell from here, and then do you know what I'd like to see, and this will be probably an unpopular one, but there's two reasons for this. One is I stage it at the Nottingham Forest football stadium where he's always wanted to fight. I'd put on the Kessler trilogy, yeah, the decider, and then I'd finish in September, well, or later next year, maybe December next year, with a Christmas fight in Vegas against Chavez or Golovkin, and that would be it. And then you've ticked three boxes: a big show in London, another domestic rival beaten if he wins. You've done the Nottingham Forest thing, and then you've done Vegas. Ticked a lot of boxes then, I think.
I like the sound of that. But I do like these sort of all-British fights.
Well, there's no getting away from it. You know, for casual fans in this country, they are drawn in by these fights. They really are. And you know, that's a great thing for the sport, definitely. But also boxing fans, you know, they're fights where you know the personalities and you can pull for one or the other, because, you know, boxing fans in this country and further afield know exactly who DeGale and Froch are, and I'm sure they have their favourites and want one or the other to win. So that adds a different element to it too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, how about this? Paul Smith beats Abraham in Germany, comes back with a world title, fights Froch. Loses to Froch, Callum Smith comes up to get revenge for his fallen brother.
Do you know what? All of that stuff sells.
Yeah, I mean, it's not entirely impossible.
No, it's not. The hardest thing I think out of that will be Paul Smith to beat Abraham, because I think that's a tough fight for Paul over there.
Yeah.
But we'll see. I thought that Froch was going to have his hands full with Abraham, and he absolutely dominated him over in Finland. Really good night that was. Still, on that Froch note, guys, I'd implore you to go out and read Froch's comments on Golovkin. There's certainly plenty of respect for the Kazakh middleweight terror. I think everyone would like to see Golovkin move up in weight. It looks like Miguel Cotto and Saul Alvarez, who are middleweight almost in name only, without going all the way up to 160 pounds, won't want to go anywhere near Golovkin. So that almost leaves him a free rein in that division. So it looks like he could be heading north to 168 before too long. That said, I still think Martin Murray might get a shot at Golovkin before the end of the year. You never know, but interesting times ahead. And guys, that concludes us for the podcast this week. Really enjoyed having your company, John.
Thanks very much for having me.